Last time we talked about these things, we talked about God created the earth. He created Adam and Eve. He blessed them and said, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish and the birds and everything. And then when God looked at what he had made, behold, it was very good. Genesis 1:31, 1 Timothy 4, 4-5, everything created by God is good. That is, we should be able to, I think Paul there is talking about certain foods where people say, oh, don't eat this, don't eat that. And Paul said, no, you can eat whatever you want because everything created by God is good. In other words, take care, take part in and be thankful for the blessings of the material world that God has put you in. Nothing is to be rejected if it's received with thanksgiving. And then 1 Timothy 6:17, Paul talks about God who richly provides us with everything to enjoy. And that includes the coffee on the back table and the little cakes and pastries and things that are back there every week. That's God richly providing us with everything to enjoy. And that's a health decision for you to make on all those things, of course, but they're there for your enjoyment. Okay, so that was where we were last week. And then we talked last week about cereal grain yields and how those have gone up incredibly over the last 50 years or so. And the percentage of people that were starving in the world as a whole, the developing world as a whole, in that bar chart has dropped dramatically over the last 50 years. I noticed on Thursday, the Associated Press, just this last Thursday, November 4th, put out a story that didn't get much coverage, but it was a United Nations report saying people around the world are, around the globe, are healthier, richer, and better educated than ever before, with most developing countries registering huge gains over the last 40 years in terms of human development, and that's in terms of the food and clothing and other resources that people have, education, access to education, water, sanitary facilities, and other kinds of measures of human development. China, Indonesia made great growth. Some Arab countries, especially Oman, and many Latin American countries showed marked progress as well. In Arab countries overall, life expectancy went from 51 to 70, life expectancy, from 1970 to 2010. That's 40 years. That's really remarkable. And the whole report is called Human Development Report 2010, United Nations. But what we're seeing is if you don't look at just individual local stories of very, very real needs, which need to be addressed, but if you look at global trends over decades, the path is very, very positive. And that's because of developing higher yielding crops and better methods of farming and agriculture. And so the amount of grain, tons per hectare of grain, is just increasing in almost all parts of the world. That was where we were last week. Now let's see if we can catch up on the outline. The outline, if you need one, hold up your hand. It's the same outline from last week. And I'm going to be on page 1, small letter C, water. Okay? So today what I want to do is look at different aspects of resource availability in the world. If God created a world that was very good, he wanted us to subdue it and have dominion over it, and he provides us with all things richly to enjoy, we would expect that the earth would be really resourceful, and there would be many, many resources here for human beings to use on the earth. That's what we would expect. And so I want to go through some of those things because there is a kind of environmentalist lobby or environmentalist alarmism or a kind of a spreading of panic. Oh, we're running out of water, we're running out of land, we're running out of food, we're running out of clean air, we're running out of space to live, we're running out of place to put our garbage, everything, we're running out. And so then the theory is, don't touch, don't touch, don't touch, don't use anything in the world, don't consume, This is evil. I mean, that's the theory or the theme that I think spreads fear and guilt. And what I want to say is, well, wait a minute. Really? Is that the kind of world that God made for us to use? And so now I want to look at water and then air and then places to store waste and global forests. And then I want to look at some oil and coal and natural gas and nuclear energy, things like that, just to make the point of the abundance of resources. Okay, so let's look at water. The percentage of people in developing countries, this is right in the middle of page one, with access to clean drinking water increased from 30% in 1970 to 80% in 2000. Can you believe that? In 30 years. Now, that's not all countries of the world. That's developing countries. The bottom of the pile in terms of per capita income, the percentage of people with access to clean drinking water, this thick bar is world average. Now, this one is showing 30% and 40% in 1970 up to this chart is a little bit messed up. The lines, I think the printed statistics are what you want, but that's the direction of the line. And it's supposed to go from 30% to 80%. Now, there's still 20% of people in developing countries who don't have good access to clean water. Well, that's a serious problem. But if the percentage you have clean water goes from 30% to 80% in 30 years, that's unbelievable. I was speaking at a conference in England, and a man came up to me and said, yeah, I was part of that. I worked in a number of African countries where we developed water accessibility, you know, wells and water transportation systems and things. And that's remarkable. And then sanitation, that means plumbing. I don't know. I guess I don't need to explain anymore. But the trend is the same. World average of people with access to sanitation facilities, so you don't have sewage running down the middle of the street or a little ditch on the side of the street, but you have regular sanitation facilities. And again, the trend over 30 years is remarkable. So then the question is, are we going to run out of water? If you give all these people access to clean drinking water, are you going to run out of water? Well, here is the overall situation with water. 71% of the Earth's surface is covered by water. Of the water that is accessible for human use, we use less than 17% of the annually renewable water on the Earth. That's not 17% of the fresh water on the Earth, because then in about 6 years you'd use it all up. This is water that's renewed every year, and we use about 17% of it. In other words, there's a lot more water available to be used. Who uses water? So now let's look at these charts. First, total water on the Earth. How much is in the oceans? 97.2% in the oceans. How much is in the polar ice caps? 2.15%. So 97 and 2 is 99, 99.35. You've got only 0.65%. That's 2/3 of 1% of all the water in the Earth is all freshwater, lakes, rivers, and groundwater. That is water under the ground. The Great Lakes, Mississippi River, all the rivers that there are in Arizona, they don't have too much water in them, but some of them do. And all that water on and all the underground water that you pump to drink from, that's just 2/3 of 1% of all the water on the Earth. And of that, that's renewed every year because it rains again every year, of that we only use 17%. So are we going to run out of water? Well, you say, well, wait a minute. I don't want to drink salt water. So 97% of the water on the Earth is salt water, so that isn't going to do me any good. Ah, but it does do people good. Kuwait gets half of its water from desalinated water, water that has salt taken out of it. And Saudi Arabia gets a large portion of its water right now from salt. water, where they take the salt out. And now there's a city in California, I think it was Carlsbad, was it, California, that they've got a desalination plant that started up to provide water for 100,000 homes or something like that. Now, what's the problem with it? Why don't people use more of this? Because it costs more. But it doesn't cost a whole lot more. So desalination of water, the cost is equal to, what the statistics I read are, less than 1/5 of a cent per gallon, or 50 cents per cubic meter in large volumes. That's less than, as I multiplied out my utility bill, it looks like I'm paying 69 cents per cubic meter now for the water in my home. And so the actual process of desalination at a kind of wholesale level or something costs less than that. So that's encouraging that it's not. Then there are other taxes and fees and things and delivery costs that are added onto it, but that's not that bad. John Blackman has been working on a chemical process or a, it's a what? A reverse osmosis process to make cheaper water that works for wastewater or desalted water. Does somebody have a microphone here? Could you just say something about that, John? The price is coming down is, I think, the point of this. Do we have a microphone? Sorry, I didn't warn you.
Yeah, well, right now we've been working for 5 years developing some new technology. Two of the partners, Scott Bio here, and we have two patents that are pending at the moment. But at the same time, we have one of the largest private corporations in the world funding an R&D project where we're purifying wastewater, which is in some ways more significant than desalination, to where the water that we're producing now is drinkable.
Oh.
And the outcome so far with the R&D project, research and development, is that we have been compared with some other new technology running side by side, and so far we've been able to produce higher quality purified water at a much lower cost per gallon and a much lower cost for the capital equipment. So the outcome looks very, very promising.
Good. Prices are coming down.
Coming down.
With technological improvement. Yeah. Thank you, John. I just thought I'd mention that. That's very encouraging. So if you go up in an airplane and you fly from here to Los Angeles, you see brown, 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 right? And then every once in a while you see some splotches of green because there's irrigation. They just got some water. And then you look off in the distance and you see the Pacific Ocean. And you should think, we just need a pipe. And a pump. Yeah. And John's plant or something like that. So I just say that to say, my goodness, if the whole world is now all the fresh water on the earth is only 2/3 of 1% of the water on the earth, my goodness, we've got unlimited resources out in the Pacific Ocean. We're never going to run out of water. That's the point. It might cost a little bit more, but not a whole lot more. Where does water use go? Global usage of water. What uses the most? Agriculture uses 69% of the water that is used. Industry uses 29%. And households only use 8%. Did you know that? So the largest producer or user of water is agriculture. And, you know, that's why I have heard, somebody correct me if this is wrong, I've heard that as Phoenix expands and so more housing developments are built, we use less water. Why is that? Because it used to be farmland. that took a whole lot of water. They'd flood everything and irrigate everything. And then you put houses and they'd just have, people take a shower or they wash their dishes or they have drip systems for their plants, but they don't use nearly as much water as agriculture. And so when residential communities take over from agriculture communities, the amount of water used drops. Good news for Phoenix. Okay, so the point of that, on the top of the next page, is when we take stabilization of the world population coming, and then increased efficiency of water usage, where people don't waste as much, and then 80% of renewable fresh water is currently not being used, and then virtually unlimited water for desalination in the oceans. That means there's no reason to expect the Earth will run out of water ever. But now you say, wait a minute, I know some place in Africa or some place in Latin America where they can't get enough water. But that's a local problem of developing the water resources that are there or transporting it from one place to another. That's not the world shortage of water. There are regional areas where water is difficult to get, but these are local problems that deal with access to water, not global water supply. Water shortages are caused by areas that lack economic development or legal and political hindrances. And I talked two weeks ago about the water being cut off to the San Joaquin Valley in Central California because of environmentalists who wanted to protect this little, what looks to me like a minnow, the Delta smelt, instead of giving the water to the human beings and the agricultural products that needed it. Okay, that's water. Next, clean air. Clean air regulation in the U.S. was a decision made by the American people via elected officials. That is, when smog got to be so bad in certain cities, the voters said, we've got to do something. And then the answer came back and said, well, it'll cost you more if you put smoke scrubbing filters on the chimneys of factories, and if you put more efficient less polluting engines in cars so that you don't get so much pollution coming out of the exhaust. It'll cost you more. And people said, good, we want clean air. We don't care if it costs us more. And so all of a sudden, a nation begins to move toward purifying its air. And that happens in every economy. Voluntarily incurring extra expense to clean up air pollution is a pattern followed by countries as their economies grow. So look at this. This is a story of London. About 1550, there wasn't much of any smoke or sulfur dioxide in London because there weren't many people there and there weren't many factories there. And, of course, they didn't have cars and trucks. It was just kind of a very nice, clean air city. And then all of a sudden, more and more houses are coming in, and they're burning more and more fires, wood and coal, to keep their houses warm. And then you get factories, and the factories just shooting sulfur dioxide and smoke out into the air. So what's happening? This line shows the amount of smoke in the air increasing, 1800, 1850, 1900, about 1880 or so, it reached its peak. And sulfur dioxide, which is that really, I think, isn't that kind of the rotten egg smell that you, anyway, it's pollution in the air. And that concentration just went way up, and people finally said, enough, get these factories, somehow clean up the smoke and somehow clean up the pollution, and they start to have rules, and then it starts to come down. Now, Margaret and I were, I remember being in London in 1970, and it was still kind of smoggy and polluted with exhaust from cars. But now you go to London, look where the graph has gone to in 2000. Now you go to London and it's clean. You can breathe any street you want. All these cars, but it's clean. I remember as a kid growing up in Wisconsin, even in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, just a town of 40,000 people, you go walk out on the street walk downtown with a lot of cars standing waiting at a stoplight. Man, it would sting your eyes and you get all this smog in your nose and it was hard to breathe. But now you can go walk down a sidewalk next to a string of 50 cars waiting at a stoplight. You don't notice it at all. The air is clean. Why? Because emissions controls began to come in the 1970s and it meant that driving a car cost you more, but people said, I'm willing to pay that price because I like to breathe clean air. clean air comes about by economic development. And so that process that happened in London, where now we're back to 1550 levels of pollution, where there wasn't anybody much living in London and no factories to speak of, now the air is clean. And so that happens in all countries. And here's the graph. As income per person grows in a country from $100 per person, you don't have any factories or cars or anything. It's just an agrarian society, no pollution. Then you start to get factories, you start to get cars and trucks, but they're belching out a lot of pollution. And the pollution grows up, and this is millions of tons of particles in a certain volume of air, and the pollution grows until you get to about $3,000 per person annual income. That's a little below where Albania is right now, the poorest country in Europe. And after about $3,000 per annual income in persons, people begin to say, I can't breathe in this city anymore. And then they begin to enact regulations to clean it up. So I have heard that because I haven't been to some of these cities, but some of the really badly polluted cities in the world are cities where economic development has just started to take off, but they don't have pollution controls yet. So for 1972, if you graph all the nations of the world, the poorer nations had higher and higher pollution levels as they increased in per capita income until about $3,000 per person. And then they began to say through their elected officials, we need to control this pollution, get rid of these trucks that are belching out smog and smoke and things, and let's control some of the smoke coming out of our factories. And as income grows, then you get down to, $40,000 or $50,000 per person, the wealthier countries of the world, and you have hardly any pollution left. Who's been to a polluted city in the world where it's hard to breathe? Where?
Buenos Aires.
Where else?
Beijing.
Yes. Oh, yeah, that's right. Beijing. Todd.
Moscow.
Mexico City. Okay. Where else?
Krakow
in Poland. Yeah. So worse than here. Worse than London. Worse than Berlin or Munich or wealthier countries, because when countries grow in income, they decrease their pollution. Does that make sense? Now, the encouraging thing is that the 1972 chart, the pollution levels were quite high at all levels of income. 1986, the pollution levels are a lot lower for all countries and all areas of income. And the reason is, as development progresses, the used cars from Phoenix that end up in Mexico City don't pollute as much. And the tractors and the trucks from Phoenix that end up in Mexico City don't, because even then they're getting cleaner old cars than they got before. Does that make sense? What's your name? Question.
Oh, Dennis.
Dennis. Yeah.
Someone mentioned Los Angeles.
Yep.
Pollution.
Yep.
Yeah,
what about the pollution in Los Angeles? Los Angeles has a problem where the air coming off the ocean gets trapped because of the mountain ranges right beyond Los Angeles, and there's a technical word for that. So it's really hard to solve, but they've done marvelous things compared to what it was in the 60s and 70s, even with that large population. Okay, so that's encouraging. So what's the answer to air pollution? Economic development. That's how you clean up air. You don't shut down factories. You just build cleaner factories. Oops. Okay. So clean air. In the United States, going down under point D, about the fourth point down, in the United States, this is from 1970 to 2000. That's 30 years. The number of miles driven in the United States by cars doubled. And the population grew by more than a third, but the emissions decreased. The amount of pollution in the air decreased when the number of miles driven doubled. Why? Because God provides resources for our benefit in the earth, and it's for us to be thankful for and use to his glory. And if that's true, it's reasonable to assume that we'll be able to discover wise ways to use these resources. The point of this is, I think God wants us to develop the earth. And the way to clean up pollution is not shut down factories and stop driving. It's to have cleaner ways of doing those things. And then we use the resources that God gave us with thanksgiving. Okay, but someone says, there's really a problem. Have you seen all the garbage that's accumulated every day in Phoenix? We're going to run out of space to store this waste. And the outline should say waste disposal, not waster disposal. Just a typo. energy production from waste incineration is cheap. We don't do this very much in the United States. I don't know why, but what France, Germany, Denmark, the UK, and Italy do with their garbage is almost all of it, they dump it into these huge, high-temperature incinerators, and they burn it, and it produces energy. And then generates electricity. And it's a very economically efficient way of generating energy. You burn your garbage. And I don't think there's much of anything left. A tiny little bit of ash, maybe, because it's heat? Oh, you generate heat energy.
It generates heat as well, and they use that, like City of Dayton.
Okay.
Runs pipes underneath streets, takes the heat.
Go ahead and take the microphone, Jerry. All right. He's got a story about Dayton, Ohio.
This goes back into the 70s, even, where Dayton, Ohio had a huge incinerator plant for their waste.
Yep.
And then they also trapped the heat and piped that underneath streets to help keep the streets free from
snow.
Ice.
Snow and ice.
And
yeah.
Salt. I mean, so it has a byproduct.
Good. Okay, good. So I don't know why that's not used more in the United States, but I think it's a very good solution. Another solution is a landfill. You take garbage and you put it in a big landfill, and then you put layers of dirt over it, and then you put another layer of garbage, and then you put a layer of dirt. When our son Oliver was running cross country in high school, we were out at this park in northwest suburban Chicago, and somebody told me, you know, this is a landfill. Oh, really? It looked like a beautiful park with trees and grassy hills, and it was great for a cross-country meet, and went on for acres and acres. There was all garbage underneath it. It was a landfill that had been filled in. It was a beautiful park. And in fact, now, the largest landfill in the world has been the Freshkills landfill on Staten Island, New York. 2,200 acres. It's been taking all the garbage from New York City for years and years and years, and now what's happening to it? It's becoming Freshkills State Park. Or Freshkills Park. It's being made from a huge landfill on Staten Island. And it took the waste from New York City from 1947 to 2001, 2,200 acres, piled it up, I don't know, way over 100 feet high. And now they put dirt over it and grass over it. And they've got, you know, sort of the, I think there's some noxious gas that emits from landfills, but they trap that and use it for burning energy or do something with it. And so now it's a park, and it's being developed over the next several years. It'll be a 2,200-acre park with a golf course and picnicking places and running and biking trails. And wow, isn't that nice? Yep, E.G.
Just a comment that's kind of interesting. Back in the late 70s, at the bank, I had a customer who developed these incinerators. In fact, they built one in West Phoenix.
Yep.
And they took the sludge, the sewer water,
yep,
the sewer stuff,
yep,
and they would burn it off, and they would get enough precious metals out of that it was a profitable business.
Wow.
And then over the next 2-3 decades, basically they had to quit doing it because the sludge had gotten so cleaned up.
Oh.
By the communities, that all the gold and silver and stuff that used to be in there,
yeah,
was gone.
Wow. Okay.
So big major change.
Yeah. Okay, good. Cleaning up the problem. Okay, so how much space would be required to receive all the garbage being produced in the United States? And I got this from this Bjorn Lomborg book that I quote in my book, The Skeptical Environmentalist. All the waste generated in the United States for the next 100 years
could fit in a square area 18 miles on each side and 100 feet high. Less than 1/1000th of 1% of the U.S. Less than 1/100th of 1% of the U.S. land area. Or if it were just each state had one, I think I have in my book something like two miles on a side, a big square, and 100 feet high. You can take all the waste for the next 100 years. Now, in fact, people aren't going to do that. They're not going to put it all in one place. They're going to be different landfills in different cities. But there's a lot of space to put landfills, if that's what we want to do with our waste, and then cover it over, and then kids can run cross-country meets on it, and you can play golf on it. Well, then why do we recycle everything? I don't know. I guess it does save some of the landfill costs. But I think there's a factual analysis needed for how much expense and time and effort there is versus the benefit for each product. Do you want to recycle paper or burn it at an incineration plant and produce new energy? And paper is a renewable resource anyway. We'll talk about that again in a few minutes when we come to forests. But what's the point of recycling when if we don't need to save space in landfills? And, you know, I guess if you want to recycle, fine, but there's a cost in human time and effort. And is it worth the trade-off of cost and time and effort? That's the question. I have my doubts. Okay, well, that's waste disposal. What about forests? Are we running out of trees? No, not if you look at worldwide trends. Start out with this. 1/3 of the earth is covered by trees. And that hasn't changed for the last 50 or 60 years. Half of the trees in the world are in four countries. Russia, Canada, Brazil, United States. Half the forests in the world. But anyway, 1/3 of the earth. The whole world has 2 to 3 times as much land taken up by forests as by cropland and agricultural land. Since 1920, the amount of forest land, the acres in the United States, have remained relatively stable. But the wood growing in the United States is 3.5 times what it was in 1920. How can that be? Using the same amount of land for trees, but we're growing 3.5, if you count the board feet in all the trees growing, it's 3.5 times as much. How can that be?
Plant more.
You plant more, Jack says. Yeah, because if a logging company goes into a forest where trees are growing in a messy way, they're not in order at all, they take out those trees and use them for wood or paper or whatever, and then they go in and they plant straight rows of trees spaced evenly, they get a lot more trees in the same land. And so you get a lot more wood growing, and so the amount of wood growing in the United States every year has increased since 1920. The amount of wood growing. And so if you look at this chart, the bars, these white, large white bars going up like this, this is the total number of cubic feet, millions of cubic feet growing in the United States. Here's 1952. Oops, here's 1952, 62, 70, 77, 87. The total amount growing has increased through that whole period. And then these other lines show different regions of the United States, North, South, Rocky Mountain. The only one that you can hardly see on the chart, it's a very faint line up here that's been going down, 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 down. That's the Pacific Coast region because of environmental challenges over some owl. And because the owl had to be protected, the logging was just driven out of the Pacific Northwest. The entire industry was shut down. I hope the owl is happy. And then as far as the world as a whole, There's been 20% loss of the original forest cover on the earth since agriculture began, since kind of modern civilization began. But it has stabilized, and the amount of forest cover in the world is about stable over time. And as countries develop, you know, what happens in poor countries is people go chop down trees and they burn them for fuel, or they use them to build houses with. And there's kind of an uncontrolled taking over of agriculture, of forest areas. And that happened in the United States. People either use the wood for fuel or they cut down the wood and they plant crops. So that starts with the country develop. But as the country begins to develop, then it starts to use coal or oil or natural gas. It doesn't use so much. How many of you burn wood in your home to keep warm? No, I don't think anybody. Well, maybe some of you do because you like burning wood to keep warm. But in general, we don't do that anymore in developed countries. And so basically, we're not running out of wood. We just plant more trees. And the amount of wood available and growing in the United States keeps increasing, and in the whole world, it's stable. Now people say, well, what about tropical rainforests? Aren't we losing those, and isn't that valuable? Most of that problem is a local problem in Brazil, and that has to be controlled by the Brazilian government. What you have is poorer people, again, spreading out into the tropical rainforest and taking that wood for either clearing some area for crops or using the wood for fuel. But I think that's being brought under control. 86% of that tropical rainforest remains. There's about less than 0.5% of loss per year. But the solution to that is economic development, so people can use other sources of fuel. So if we don't need to recycle paper to save landfill space, and we don't need to recycle paper to save trees, because one third of the world's surface is trees, and more trees growing than more wood growing than ever, why recycle paper? So now that brings me back to my decision when I walk into Staples. $5.79 for 12 of these legal pads. Just good old normal paper. Recycled, I could buy this for $8.99 with recycled paper. The price tells you that the cost of recycling paper is higher than the cost of just making new paper from trees and burning the old paper or putting it in a landfill. Do I want to spend $5.79 or $8.99? I think I'll save the $3.20 and get the normal paper, not the recycled paper. I don't see the reason for buying recycled paper. Vic, you got a reason?
I'm going to check your research back because my guess is it's all right to go. Go,
he's a microphone coming. Go ahead.
I want to check the research of that because my business is pulverizing film, surface chemistry, and, yep, and paper. And I've lived in Wisconsin for 16 years. And Wisconsin, of course, being a big forest industry state, we did a lot of recycling. All the large paper mills up in Fox Valley area.
Yep, yep.
Businessman's not going to recycle unless they cannot pay back.
Unless the government gives you subsidies, which means the taxpayers are paying for it.
So it's the case because if you look at every large grocery store, they recycle because they don't have the landfill, but they get paid for that. I had a friend who was a paper broker that would ship up like newsprint,
yep,
for years.
Yep.
Everyone remembers your little Cub Scout, Boy Scout.
Yep, yep, I did that too.
And so there is an economic benefit to it. And also there's other things that we may not be aware of. For example, in plastics, plastics has a lot of chemicals on it. Phthalates being one of them. As a society, most of us are not aware of that. And if you look at what they're doing in Europe, for example, ROHS is a basically a regulation of reduction of hazardous waste. We have that in this country also. But I'll give an example. If you look at the billboards around the city, for years they used 30 sheet, which was paper, but the inks were not good enough to be good enough. Then they went to PVC, which is polyvinyl chloride. They have heavy metals in it. The heavy metals have since been reduced, but PVCs are still not good to cut in your landfills. Then we're evolving where now we're using some films like polyethylenes for billboards. I'm going to bring those company up in Longmont, Colorado, Circle Graphics, largest commercial printer in the world for wide format. He basically owns the billboard market, and basically he has environmentally friendly material. So the benefits is that it gets back to stewardship. sometimes there's a little bit of a premium initially, but as the economy scales, get to the point that you're producing high volume, that price drops. And that point that it drops, it's better for society, it's better for environment, and it's cost effective to do it. And when you look at the heavy metals that we're not aware of, there's a lot of problems with it.
Bring me more information, Vic, if you'd like to do that. But I'm going to look at it very carefully because there are some other factors involved, and that is there is an environmental movement that tries to get us not to use anything, and there is, I mean, companies might say for the public relations benefit of showing that we're environmentally sensitive, we'll say our containers use so-and-so recycled paper or something like that. And we're willing to pay the extra cost of it because it's like advertising or like public relations good because it's the environmentally friendly thing to do, and that's the trend in the culture. So that's one factor. The other factor is it's a question of researching fact to know whether PVC is harmful in landfills. And there's a ton of PVC, tons and tons of PVC in the Fresh Kills landfill, for instance, and they're fine with it. So
PVCs, for example, the PVCs you had 10 years ago are not
yeah.
PVCs again.
Yeah, yeah.
And the coalition of Northeast governors called CONAG, they had a big push probably about 10, 15 years ago to take heavy metals out of it.
Yeah.
The fact of the matter that that is better because if you have children, for example, with plastic toys that have those heavy metals,
yeah.
It's not healthy.
Yeah, I understand. So I wonder if there are alternative scientific studies that talk about the relative danger and the cost. That's the question. It's just a matter of question of facts. But this tells me it's a lot more expensive to get recycled, that the cost for recycled paper, because Staples would sell them for the same price if they could.
It may also be green products because the economies are not there.
Yeah.
Charge a higher price.
Could be.
I just introduced a new line of green products for our company.
Yep.
And there's a 10% premium.
Sure.
And until that 10% premium is gone, no one,
yep.
No one talks green, no one wants to pay.
Yeah. 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 So the price still is a measure of what the actual total cost is. And there's public relations subsidy and maybe government subsidy in the recycled paper, and it still costs $3 more. So I don't buy it. No, they're both white. I just did the two different colors. Yeah, yeah. They're both white. Okay, so now Jack's keeping me on schedule here. Okay, let's see. Okay, I'm going to skip section G, species loss. It's in my book. It's not nearly as alarming as people have made it out to be. And herbicides and pesticides, I'm going to skip over that. I'm saying, man, it makes our crops much more productive, and if we got rid of these herbicides and pesticides, food would be much, much more expensive, and people wouldn't eat as healthy diets. And the supposed risk from herbicides and pesticides, Lomberg says, is very, very slight. It's very, very slight when you actually look at the statistics. Life expectancy is going up, and that's just a great quick measure of overall quality of life, because if people can get medical care or get food that lets them live longer, then they like to do that. And so when life expectancy goes up, and I said that report, even in less developed countries, it's been increasing remarkably. That shows that the ability of human beings to take the resources of the earth and make them useful have been growing. So that's great. Now, I want to do, that's life expectancy growing up. Now I want to do world energy production by source. I don't know if you can read this chart on the bottom of the page, but here's the point. I'm going to say We're not running out of energy resources. Not anywhere near running out of energy resources. Energy production is derived from several different sources. Of the total energy used in the world in 2006, which is the most recent data I could get, 33% of the energy came from oil. That's the largest percentage. 27% came from coal. 22% came from natural gas. This surprised me. Hydroelectric plants from dams on rivers, only 6.3%. I thought it might have been higher than that, but not true. And then nuclear power worldwide, 5.9%, or about 6%. And then this little slice up at the top, natural gas plants, liquids from biomass, 2.4%. And then up at the top, solar power, I think it says 0.9%, wind 0.6%, geothermal, which is heat from the earth, 0.5%, just tiny, tiny slices. That's right now where we're getting all the energy. Now, when we look at those sources, what are the prospects for them? Wind power. In 2008, the total amount of world energy capacity from wind power was 121 gigawatts, and it grew 21%. But how much is that? Well, wind power is actually unreliable, and so it probably produces at about 20% of capacity and 1.9% of America's electricity. And the problem with wind is that it's not a dependable source of energy, and it requires huge amounts of land. And what else is happening to people who live within several miles of wind power factories? What are they complaining about? The noise. Thump, 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 all night long, all day long. And people are saying, nobody told us about this. So, and they're ugly. If you've driven from here to Palm Springs, you, my goodness, there's a whole wind farm. They catch on fire? Really? Okay. So, but it's unreliable, because what do you do when the wind isn't blowing? You've got to have some other source of energy. So I'm not real hopeful about wind energy. Maybe some, but not much. Hydroelectric power from, the U.S. gets 5.7% of its energy from hydroelectric dams. Most of the good places to build those have already been built. So not much more is going to come from hydroelectric. And worldwide as well. Oil. We're constantly discovering new reserves of oil. When the price of oil increases, then drilling in more difficult areas becomes economically feasible. And so, if we look at this, okay. Known world oil reserves and world oil production, there's a very light line down at the bottom of this chart. It's world oil production from 1950 to 2000, and it's right there in 2000. Known world oil reserves, the price of oil starts going up. People start exploring. They say, wait a minute, what about offshore regions? What about deeper offshore regions? What about farther underground regions? And the total amount of billions of barrels of world oil reserves is way up here. And the production is way down here. So we keep finding more because more areas become economically feasible to develop. Oil available in tar sands and shale oil fields, and the amount of oil remaining, by one estimate, is equal to the total energy consumption of the entire world for the next 5,000 years. Are we going to be... Yeah. Gloria's saying the rapture is going to come before 5,000 years. She thinks Christ is going to come back. Well, we don't know. We need to be wise. But that's, I mean, there are going to be other sources of energy developed before then, 5,000 years. So I think we're never going to run out of oil. But I'm nervous about our dependence on foreign oil, and so I think we should increase alternative fuels when it's practical to do so, nuclear for one thing and a solar for another. And I would like to see us develop more of our own supplies of oil. The Alaskan Wildlife National Wildlife Refuge has no human inhabitants, and we could get as much oil as is presently imported from Saudi Arabia. And Colorado itself could produce 46,000 barrels a day. And we need to expand oil refining as well, because we haven't had oil refineries built or come online, and that keeps prices artificially high for gas. But That's my teaching assistant, Sean Reynolds, and I in Alaska about 6 weeks ago, and we are at the Alaska oil pipeline outside of Fairbanks. And that's what it looks like. And if you want, I climbed up on the little supporting platform there to touch it. And that's an 800-mile pipeline that runs from the north coast of Alaska in Prudhoe Bay down to Valdez and pumps oil. It's running at maybe a third capacity now because I'm not sure of various reasons. But it's way up here in this part of Alaska, and it pumps it down here to, I think, down here, Valdez someplace, and then shipped to the United States and elsewhere. The Alaska National Wildlife Refuge is this green area in Alaska. It's 20 million acres in size. That's a little less than a third the size of Arizona. And there's proposal to drill on 2,000 of the 20 million acres, or less than, or about 1/100 of 1% of it. Somebody said it's like drilling on the size of a postage stamp on a football field. It's a very tiny part. How many people live in Anwar? Zero. It's cold. There are some Inuit Indians offshore here on an island, and they would like drilling. All the population of Alaska strongly favors drilling. It would supply 1.3 million barrels of oil per day. We get 1 million barrels from Saudi Arabia. So it would replace what we get from Saudi Arabia. But it's been tied up in Congress in political back and forth infighting for 15 years now. And it's basically a Republican-Democrat division where the Democrats have said, no, don't touch it. It's a natural wildlife refuge. We can't drill there. And the Republicans have said, we should drill there. This is important. It help us have affordable oil. And when George Bush was president, the Republicans looked like they had the majority in the Senate to get this through, and there was some political maneuvering, and a couple of wobbly Republicans switched sides, and it wasn't approved. So it sits there not being approved. But I think it's excellent and would be a great source of energy for us, so that'll continue to be a controversy. How am I doing on time? Let's see. Let's see if I can go quickly on this. Coal, a widely used source of energy. Modern coal-burning power plants are much cleaner and more efficient than in previous years. Total availability of coal so far worldwide is 1,500 years worth of usage if we just keep using what we're using, I guess. But again, there will be substitutes with other sources of energy. Natural gas, a wonderful source of energy and still a lot available. Nuclear power, wow. The energy produced by 1 gram of uranium-235. Now, I tried to bring 1 gram of uranium-235, but I didn't have a scale that would measure it enough. And actually, these are aspirins. These are not uranium-235. But the aspirin bottle said these are 325 milligrams. So 3 aspirins makes 1 gram of aspirin. But my guess is there's filler in here. So anyway, imagine this is something like 1 gram. That's 1/28th of an ounce of uranium-235. Whoops. Oh, I dropped some uranium-235, John. All right. Size of 3 aspirins. Okay. That amount of uranium-235 produces equivalent energy to 3 tons of coal. 3 tons. 6,000 pounds of coal. Whoa. So nuclear energy has almost no pollution, but radioactive waste requires safe storage. All people say, where are we going to store the waste, the radioactive waste? Well, the yearly nuclear waste of over 1 million people could be stored in a properly made container the size of a 40-gallon steel drum. Think of your 40-gallon water heater. That's how much you would need, actually just the inside part of your 40-gallon water heater that holds the water, not the insulation. Or if you think, picture a 40-gallon drum, if you look at a steel, 1 million people, that's how much their nuclear waste could be stored in that that drum for a whole year. 1 million people. And so France, Japan, other countries have figured this out. It's periodically stored, and then eventually it's buried deep underground. France gets almost 77% of its electricity from nuclear power. Japan gets 25%. We should be getting a lot more. It's safe. It's efficient. Nobody has ever been killed in an accident at a nuclear power plant in the United States or in any Western country. The Russians messed one up at Chernobyl. Yeah, but that was carelessness and very low safety regulations. We have 104 operating nuclear power plants in the United States. They now provide 20% of our electricity. They could provide 80 or 90% of our electricity if we would get the opposition of environmentalists and anti-nuclear people who have irrational fears out of the way and clear the political way for approval of power plants. But there are endless legal and regulatory barriers, so we've had no new nuclear power plants built in the United States since 1975. Senator Domenici from New Mexico, who was pushing for more nuclear energy, said many Americans have an irrational fear of anything nuclear, and then there's deliberate misinformation that opponents of nuclear energy employ with shameless disregard of the truth. I had an argument with someone who said no one died at Three Mile Island. Oh, yeah, people died. People died. No, no one died at Three Mile Island. There were no injuries. And it was just something was leaking, but it didn't contaminate or hurt anybody. So there's now sufficient uranium for up to 14,000 years of energy production. And it's really the safest of all energy sources. So I want to encourage that. Solar energy, the price is not yet competitive, but the solar energy falling on the Earth every year is equal to 7,000 times the amount of energy we use every year on the Earth. Greatest source of energy that there is, more than all these other sources of energy. My conclusion, there's an incredibly abundant amount of energy available on the Earth for human use. God put us on the earth so we would develop and use his resources wisely. And it's reasonable to think that he would provide us with multiple sources of energy that we could discover in order to perform the tasks he gives us to do, to subdue the earth. Energy reduction is not a virtue. Energy is what replaces human work. When I see a label on something that says reduces energy, I want to add increases your work. Seems to me. Energy. Yep, questions pretty soon. Energy makes economic development possible. Increasing energy usage for good productive work that glorifies God is a virtue. It decreases the time we need to spend, increases our productivity and prosperity, increases our freedom. Now, reducing personal energy use to save money is wise. I mean, if you want to turn off your lights, I think you should, because why waste the money when you're not at home? I don't want to waste. And turn off the faucet when you're not using the water. Yeah, don't waste resources. But just in general saying I'm using less resources means you're probably getting less work done if you're not wasting. Reducing energy usage to the extent that quality of life and work efficiency suffer is not. And I think the amount of energy remaining in these sources is going to be a lot more than we have. So we got a new dishwasher, and it reduces energy. But it takes 4 hours to wash the dishes instead of one. And now, and in my closet at home and in the bathroom, I go in and now we have energy efficient light bulbs. Fine, but I've got to wait a minute before I can read anything because the thing takes so long to give light to the room. So reducing energy is just increasing human inconvenience and human work. Okay, I'm sure there are some questions. John, where's the microphone here?
The question is the comment.
We're not running out of energy, in other words. John.
This is to add to your outline.
Yeah.
Are you aware of this about the Valdez pipeline?
Yeah, there was a spill.
800 miles long.
Oh, the pipeline, yeah.
and it goes over two mountain ranges.
Yep.
If you drilled in Anwar, you get that, it's 70 miles dead straight at dead level to hit that pipeline.
So, and it's sitting there at one-third capacity.
And the rules or whatever written up on top, if they stop running oil through it, they have to dismantle the whole thing.
Oh, man. So that's, see, John, I didn't say this in my outline, but I should say this. There are some people who just, I think, are sincere and they're wrong about facts. But I think there are other people who think it's wrong to touch the earth. And so their whole goal is to shut the country down. Just to shut down all the production we're doing, all the economic development we're doing. Don't touch this, don't touch that, don't use oil, don't use coal, don't use natural gas, don't use nuclear energy. And the windmills are killing the birds and the... So, there is an anti-development mentality among some people. They're just trying to harm the United States and all Western countries. And the way you do that is you cut off the energy supply. So I think it's a pernicious kind of motivation on the part of at least some people who maybe just... some are probably sincere and misled. Some are maybe deceived more deeply. Yeah. Good. Okay, E.G.?
Better stock up on those light bulbs that you can see by because they've quit making them, as I understand.
I know, 2014. And what that does is nibble away at my freedom because now I've taken another minute where I've got to wait till I can read something or find what color pants I'm going to get out of the closet. I mean, but they're nibble away, and decreases my efficiency at work. So, yep. I hope Congress changes that law. Okay, way in back here. Yeah, unless the law changes. Surely.
I understand these new bulbs have mercury in them.
Yep.
You break them, you've got a huge problem.
Yep.
Safety-wise to him.
Yep. Doesn't matter. We're going to reduce energy.
And regarding saving the environment for the, like, pygmy owl, maybe there's a lot of people that believe in reincarnation and they think they're going to come back as a pygmy owl.
Now, I didn't really figure that into the cost of my recycled paper, but maybe a few cents going for the pygmy owl. Okay, over here and then over here. What's your name?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good. Have you looked at how much phosphorus is left in the world and how long will our supply of phosphorus last?
I had a friend who looked at it and said, he was an economist, he said he thinks we might run out of phosphorus in 5,000 years. Okay, but here's the question. Will human beings develop substitutes? See, another reason we're not going to run out is if oil becomes too expensive, what do? You drive electric cars that are powered by nuclear power. So human beings always substitute for something else. Now, whether there's a substitute for phosphorus or not, or maybe it can be reclaimed, I don't know. Or maybe there needs to be some new development for, yeah. But good question. Over here.
But just to piggyback on a few things you said about the people who don't want to touch, period.
Yep.
We've invested a lot of money, millions of dollars actually, in developing the McDowell Mountain Reserve.
Yep.
There's an actual commission that reports to the city council of Scottsdale, and there are people like that on there. When we voted the referendum in to get the money to actually buy that land.
Right.
Their agenda was actually to put a big fence around it so nobody could actually even enter it.
Keep it for the rattlesnakes and coyotes.
And,
wow. It's don't touch the earth. That's the radical environmentalist. Yep.
And the landfill, Cave Creek Golf Club, 19th Avenue in Greenway, was a former landfill. It's a nice place to play golf.
Cave Creek Golf Club was a landfill?
Yes.
Wow. Good. Thanks. Oh, I forgot to tell you, why don't people want to drill in the Alaska National Wildlife Refuge? Because it will harm the caribou, so they say. And we could get as much, and then other people say, no, it's not going to harm the caribou. The current pipeline hasn't harmed the caribou. And, you know, 1/10 of 1/100 of 1% of the land. Okay, well, back to the main point. God gave us a wonderful earth. He gave us incredible resources in the earth, energy resources, water resources, the ability to produce energy and still keep clean air. He's given us land that we can grow crops on, given us trees and places to grow trees. I think we should not waste. We should be wise in our use of resources, but we should use resources that God has put there for our benefit and with thanksgiving to Him. That's the point. Next week, or Barry, I'll see you next week.